Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 151. On this week's show, we are going to review 1979's The Black Hole. With me, as always, to my left is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining us via Skype from the Main Street Gazette is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And from the same central-ish neighborhood is Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
Hello, Pete. And welcome back, everybody. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, for visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, or traveling to heaven and or hell, visit the experts over at MEI-travel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. You can find our website over at lastgenpodcast.com. We have a Twitter, at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. Facebook, that is the most active of grounds. You can search for Disney Magic Hour, add yourself to the group. If you're already in there, add your friends. We're on iTunes, we're on Google Play Music and Stitcher, but we also have pictures and a Patreon. Melissa, where can everyone find those?
On Instagram, we're at Disney Magic Hour. And if you head over to patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour, you can find ways to support the show there. I think I said the Instagram wrong. I think it's at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. It is.
It's Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
I goofed. Oops.
It is. Ryan, aforementioned of the Main Street Gazette, where can everyone find that?
That's at mainstgazette.com. It's mainstgazette on Twitter and Instagram if you're looking for us there. And if you search for Main Street Gazette on Facebook, you can find the page too.
Ryan's wearing flannel.
It's a bit chilly up here.
Courtney looks like she's wearing sort of a sweatery kind of thing.
I'm wearing a Dream Theater shirt and a blanket.
Nice. That's a sweater in my
opinion. Also have a blanket.
Yes, it's also not. Anyways, so here we are back again to discuss movies, of all things.
Huzzah.
Huzzah. We are back, and we've got a real doozy for you. This is a movie we actually had already watched.
Yes.
What, 3 months ago?
The date on my notes is August 4th.
What?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
I actually thought it was further back than that.
Wait, so almost 3 months to the day?
Yeah. That's when I saved my notes last.
Oh, my God. All right. So what movie are we talking about? We are talking about 1979's The Black Hole. There's a fair amount to dig into this. So we're gonna dive right into this. We're going to talk about some of the history of the film. If you guys don't remember, because it's been a while, how the overall format of what we do over here is the such. I'll talk about the production a little bit. Ryan's going to tell you a bunch about the story. Courtney, probably against her will this week, is going to tell us about the music. Melissa's going to tell us about the actors involved. And then we're all going to talk about the plot therein. And at the end of every episode, we ask three questions. Melissa, what are those three questions?
We're going to ask if it still holds up.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to ask if it had a moral or was it an emotional pull to the film and if it succeeded at doing either and or both.
Jesus.
And we're going to pick the iconic shot of the film.
Yeah. All right. We'll get to that last one eventually.
I got at least one of those.
Yeah? Okay, good. All right, so basically bolstered by the success of Star Wars, Disney VP at the time, Ron Miller, decided to reactivate an old idea originally titled Space Station 1, but they would slightly adjust the film to the title Space Probe 1, this being much sexier and more attractive than the initial title. The original pitch was featured with director Winston Hibbler in the main chair, and designs from the then-retired Peter Ellenshaw. They actually took him out of retirement. Well, they like go to his house and it's like, draw, man, draw. But he actually came out of retirement to work on this. Just so you know, this was a big thing because his previous work, very renowned, Red Shoes, Treasure Island, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Darby O'Gill, even Mary Poppins. And actually what winds up happening is the work actually gets done directorial-wise by Gary Nelson because Hibbler passes away. And then after Hibbler, Disney asked John Hughes. John Hughes passed on the project. So Gary Nelson, largely known for TV, and at the time he was hot off an Emmy nomination for Washington Behind Closed Doors. So he was a little bit of a hot ticket right then. Following Black Hole, though, he sort of returns to TV for the majority of his remaining career, which featured 96 separate directing credits. So it's not like, you know, he was a Johnny Come Lately. Is that the right term?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that. Behind the camera was Frank Phillips, which we've said his name multiple times on this show because he previously photographed Return to Witch Mountain, Peach Dragon, Escape to Witch Mountain, and even Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. But before all of that, there had to be a story, I am told. Ryan, where does the story of the Black Hole... Because actually, the reason that it wound up becoming titled The Black Hole was simply because it was a hot-button thing in science at the time, and they noticed that most of the plot revolved around the Black Hole anyway, and who couldn't get hot over the title Space Station One? That is like the earliest draft of an attraction at Tomorrowland. But where did the story come from?
So there actually was a Space Station X1 at Disneyland. Like, it was a walk-through space kind of attraction. So you're absolutely right. But so we're going to go back. We're going to talk about Winston Hibler. So if that name sounds vaguely familiar, it's because he has written things like The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, a handful of the True Life Adventures. So you have all of this work, and he has conceived this idea of Space Station 1, which is actually going to be a disaster film. The film's a disaster on its own. We'll get to that later. But the Black Hole was going to kind of be this background feature, and that was where they went to Peter Ellenshaw to pull him out of retirement to design these maps for them, because nobody does a map painting like an Ellenshaw. And they were so taken with that work, they decided, no, you know what? We need to make that more central to the script. And we get the title of The Black Hole because literally a marketing director did, and I'm going to put this in air quotes, scientific research, and was like, yes, this is power and mystique, and we need to go with The Black Hole. But it goes through a bunch of hands, including, you know, writing credits go to Jeb Rosebrook, Bob Barbosh, Richard Landau, Jeb Rosebrook, Jerry Day. So you have a ton of hands that get into the story, which I think ends up diluting several of the key moments in the movie, or several of the themes throughout the movie. But you finally do end up with Gary Nelson, who's going to push this forward, and we get the Black Hole as the science fiction feat that, you know, we're going to focus on the Black Hole and what it is to go through a Black Hole, which in later years, just the past couple of years, you get people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is like, this is the least scientifically accurate movie of all time.
Yeah.
I like that quote.
Did he really? That was what he said? He like nailed this one down specifically?
Yep. Yeah. This is it. This is the least scientific. But if you consider where it's coming in the science fiction kind of story realm, this is coming out 2 years after Star Wars. It comes out 6 months after Alien has come out, 2 weeks after Star Trek the Motion Picture, and 6 months before Empire Strikes Back. So there is a pedigree of science fiction film that this landed in the middle of that just the bar is there, and it's reaching for it, and it never quite gets there.
And when you watch those other movies, the visual of those other films, and you compare it to this, Black Hole looks like an old sci-fi film where all the others have held up. But you can't actually knock it too much, oddly, on the visuals, because it got nominated for 2 Academy Awards in this year. Best Cinematography and Best Visual Effects. It lost to Apocalypse Now for cinematography and Alien, as you just mentioned, for Best Visual Effects. But it got nominated. So, I mean, they were doing something. They actually created an entire camera system for this film, ACES, because they wanted to rent the equipment through ILM, but due to basically a budgetary limit, they couldn't get that equipment, so they made their own. And it was pretty well respected.
I have to interject. I think it's hysterical that Disney was making a sci-fi film and they were like, oh wait, budget constraints, we can't rent this equipment from Lucasfilm. And then like, you know, however many years later, they're like, we're going to just buy it. Also, their love for acronyms in this film is bananas.
it's a good point.
ACES is right up there.
Aces is right up there. So we have, you know, we have a story now. We have a crew. So most of them. We got a cast. We got a crew. Do we have a cast, Melissa?
Yes.
This is a pretty good cast.
Can I actually tell you something else that I found interesting?
No.
Before we get to cast, I did find some interesting stuff. So we talked about...
I won't listen.
Listen to me! So we talked about the camera system that they created, Aces. Well... Oh, apparently I said Siri
Melissa
again.
Said Ace, is it sound too close to Siri? And it awoke Siri. Who, yeah, you're not sure if you understand. You must have been watching the plot. How's this thing on?
Yeah, I don't know how your phone always picks up me saying that word. That doesn't make any sense.
It's so weird. I have it on sleep mode, too.
That is weird. Put it on battery saver. That usually shuts it off.
All right.
Anyway... So the system that they created, it enabled the camera to move over a matte painting, and it was the opening credit sequence was the longest computer graphics shot that was at that time filmed.
Yes, I read that actually somewhere. I'm sorry, Neil Gaiman just responded to me about this movie.
Oh, well, then I lost all attention.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. That's why your Siri thing also is what made me realize that. We'll get to that later. I'm sorry. Okay, so they had the longest digital shot, right?
The longest computer graphics intro.
What would later be? To Tron? Would Tron be up there or something like that, Ryan?
Probably close.
It's got to be close, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
So, Melissa, going back to the action to the cast, what do you have there for casties?
I have some good casties. Let's start with our man, Dr. Hans Reinhardt, who is played by Mr. Maximilian Schnell. Schell. There's no N there.
Although Schnell is a word.
Yes.
Not the one we're
not
looking for.
Not the one I was looking for. He didn't have many acting credits that I found interesting. He has a ton, but I found a couple... that were interesting. He was in The Man in the Glass Booth in 1975. He was nominated for Best Actor. He was in Judgment at Nuremberg in 1961 and won Best Actor. He was in Abraham in 1994. He played the Pharaoh, which, coming from this movie, I think is brilliant. And he was also in Deep Impact in 1998, so going back to his, you know, sci-fi roots.
Is that the one with the whales? It's whales!
Pretty You're sure the one with the whales.
Watch it. Oh, no, that was the other thing. Deep Impact was... I think it actually may have been this one. Yeah.
That, no, that's not the whales.
Well, no, there's one where, like, whales save... It's not Star Trek IV. I'm not referring to that. I'm thinking of something else. Deep Space Impact whales? Was with Morgan Freeman as president. We're all going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one was bad. There's a lot of bad movies around that time. Okay, I will say that he has one hell of a resume, but yes, okay.
He does. I said that, you know, ones that I picked. There were also a couple of, you know.
Did you notice that his name is actually the name of the robot that he controls?
I did.
Is that on purpose?
I don't know.
I've never been able to track it down. I've tried. I can't pin it down.
All right.
It made my notes a little bit hodgepodge for a minute, but yes.
What I found said that that they had the name of the robot first, and then they cast him, and then they respelled the name of the robot to match his name.
That's good.
All right, sure. I'll go with that. Even if it's not real, I want to believe that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll go with that because, I mean, you consider everyone who was considered for that role, I imagine they had the robot name before they had the actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving on, I'm going to go to Dr. Alex Duran, who's played by Mr. Anthony Perkins. I mean, he's best known for Norman Bates in Psycho, as well as the multiple other Psycho movies that followed, which I did not realize there were four of them.
Oh, they're all bad, too.
I did not realize all those.
They're really bad.
But he was also in The Tin Star, The Matchmaker, Green Mansions. He was in an Orson Welles Kafka adaptation of The Trial. He was in Murder on the Orient Express, and I found he was in a television Les Miserables in 1978, where he played Javert, and Mr. Ian Holm played the Master of the House.
That's good.
Yeah, I kind of want to track that down.
That's good. I would actually like to watch that.
So, and that was just a year before this movie. So that'd be interesting. Following him, we have Captain Dan Hollard. He's played by Robert Forster.
Yes.
He had a very kind of weird resume as well. He was in a lot of 80s B-cult movies. They were just really fun ones. Alligator, Vigilante, The Delta Force, because why not? And then he also was in Tarantino's Jackie Brown, Mulholland Drive, and The Descendants with George Clooney.
So just to kind of give you a thing on that, that is the most Tarantino thing to do, is basically Jackie Brown. He hadn't done anything very, very, you know, mainstream for a while, and getting Forster to be pretty much, I know he's not the title character, but he's kind of the lead in many ways in that film. To have him on there with Pam Grier was a Tarantino marriage in many ways. So that was a big moment for him to come back to the very, like John Travolta, you know, in Pulp Fiction. This is pretty much the equal of that in the Tarantino universe.
And Forrester did a lot of TV work, and actually thought you'd find this interesting. He won a Saturn Award for the Breaking Bad episode Granite State. Sorry, can't read my notes.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
I don't remember that specific episode, but that's really cool.
Yeah. Moving on, we have Lieutenant Charlie Pizer?
I think it's Pizer.
All right. Pizer.
We'll go with Pizer.
Because I thought that they said Pfizer at first, and I was like, what?
Ryan did the same thing.
I just kept calling him Buck Rogers the entire time.
I mean, that's an option. He's played by Joseph Bottoms, which is the most television name.
That's a good name.
He won a Golden Globe for a new star in The Dove in 1974, so he's kind of still new. He did a miniseries of the Holocaust in 1978, and he was also on the Disneyland episode of Wonderful World of Color. And that's really all I have for him.
Okay.
If you want to interject with anything. Now we have Dr. Kate McCree, who...
I want to see how you say this.
Why?
Because I'm curious.
Is it Yvette Mimieux?
Mimieux, yeah.
Okay. I knew it was French. But that's about it. I found one bit of interesting information. She was one of, now this kind of makes sense. Back in 1957, Elvis Presley was holding a beauty contest. Mimieux was one of four finalists in this beauty contest who would then go on to be, the finalist would go on to be cast in Jailhouse Rock for a quote and unquote girl in bathing suit role. But she did not win. So I just thought that was interesting. She was also in 1960, The Time Machine, Toys in the Attic. The Disney comedy, I swear, is Monkey Go Home, and Jackson County Jail with Tommy Lee Jones.
So she's basically in one of the greatest sci-fi films of all time, Weena.
The
she
Black
was in
Hole.
Time Machine, Weena. And then she's in Black Hole.
Yeah.
The poster for Toys in the Attic 1963 is... unintentionally hilarious or really offensive. It looks like Dean Martin is slapping the bejesus out of a woman on that poster, and he looks like half zombie hand. It's really weird.
It's no good.
Yeah. I've never seen that. George Roy Hill made that movie too. Oh. Fascinating. Of The Sting and Butch Cassidy. Huh.
He's for sure slapping the crap out of that woman.
He is, right? I mean, they're not dancing really terribly, are they?
It is the aftermath of a serious slap.
Yes.
They've just got married. I want to read the thing to this. Blah, 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 blah. Unpaid, New Orleans, Chicago. Yeah, this is all about hitting a woman. All right. Toys in the Attic, everyone. We'll probably never review that one. Yes, Melissa?
Okay. I have Harry Booth, who's played by none other than Ernest Borgnine. He has a whole slew of things on his list, but I just picked out Marty, All Quiet on the Western Front, Mikhail's Navy, Airwolf, and my very favorite, he was the voice of Mermaid Man from SpongeBob.
Oh, sweet.
Exactly.
also The Wild Bunch, Escape. Marty is also the best picture.
Yes.
1955.
And, best actor he won.
That was the question on Quiz Show that the contestant was told to get wrong, so that what was his name? What was Ralph Fiennes' name? Van Doren, Charles Van Doren, can get the win, And that was part of the fix. They had him lose on a question that everyone would know because they thought it would be like poetic for one of the smartest people that's ever been on the show to lose to such an easy question, Marty. He answered on the waterfront.
Yes. I remember that movie. I also thought, remember how I keep bringing up that Alice in Wonderland TV movie that I want to track down?
No, yes. I've never heard you say that before.
Really, really good TV show. Now, anyway, Ernest Borgnine played the lion in that one, so I really need to track it down.
What lion? Like specific?
The Cowardly Lion.
Oh,
no, not.
Wait, what?
Wait a second.
Sorry, I got my things confused. No, I don't know. He was the lion, so I gotta find.
All right.
Where that movie is and find out where the lion comes from. Because yeah, I
like
don't
know. Like the lion flower.
That's yeah.
Maybe
I
don't know. He just
flower.
Says the lion, and I like want to find out where this comes from.
Does he come from a wardrobe?
Maybe
this is just a big crossover.
They did wind up in England at one point in that movie. All right, finally we have Captain Star, also known as Special Troops Arms Regiment. Captain Star.
Who was he in this movie? I don't even remember this guy.
Tom McLaughlin.
Oh, the robot.
Yes.
They hired an actor for that role. It wasn't just like, hey, you, get over here.
Do you want to know what he's most notable for?
Captain Star?
Besides that, you're a good point. For directing, he directed Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. Sorry, sure. I had to do Roman numerals in my head. One Dark Night and The Staircase Murders. So,
Staircase Murders.
Like
the Netflix thing? The Netflix special?
I don't know. I don't think so.
That cannot be right. I have to find this out.
The Staircase has got to be different from The Staircase Murders.
But what if it's based on the same thing?
But that just happened like kind of recently. I mean, not super recently.
Oh, it was 2007.
Yeah, I think that was the first one. Before the...
After calling 911 to report his wife's accidental death.
The first section of it, like before they go into what just came out on Netflix.
Kevin Pollak is in it.
Oh, so it's an actual movie.
Yeah, it's like an actual movie.
It was like the
Everyone's
first
wearing
one.
Owl hats. No, I'm just kidding. That'd be so good. How about that?
So, our good Captain Star.
How great is that show? How great was that Netflix series?
It was very
so good.
When the guy, when he got like told, someone said you paid them for sex. He's like, I would never do that. Well, we have emails that say your name on it. Oh, yeah, that was me. Oh, Ryan just sent me a picture from the new Cats movie, I believe. Oh, no, that is Ernest Borgnine as a freaking lion.
See,
and Bo Bridges as a unicorn.
Oh, God, that's Bo Bridges.
See, I have to find this movie. Look, I don't know what that thing in the background with that nose is, but...
Looks like Mario. Looks like if Mario had a tomato.
If Mario and the Swedish chef had, like, melded.
Oh, wow. All right, guys.
That's 100% Bo Bridges.
We just found the cover art, half of it anyway. Ryan, shoot me over that in an email, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much.
All right, I have two more voices to get through.
Yes, you do.
The voice of Vincent was by Mr. Roddy McDowall.
Oh, my God.
He's best known for Planet of the Apes, but I also picked out he...
you better say it.
I don't know. You make me nervous when you do that. He portrayed Augustus in Cleopatra. He was nominated for a Golden Globe Award. He was also in That Darn Cat, Inside Daisy Clover, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, of course, The Poseidon Adventure, Funny Lady, Friday Night, and Friday Night Part 2.
Fright Night.
Fright Night. Sorry. I can't read sideways. And A Bug's Life.
Wait,
I know I missed a ton
read
of them.
Sideways? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, because I'm looking at my notes sideways, but I'm speaking into the microphone.
Oh,
I gotcha. I'm like side-eyeing my notes.
I would just like to point out he was also Portafoy in Night Gallery.
I never watched Night Gallery.
Actually, no, he wasn't Portafoy. He was the guy who was Portafoy's boss. Absolutely phenomenal. If you've never seen Night Gallery, Roddy McDowall is in the best one, in my opinion, in that one. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to spoil anything. Portafoy, are you there? All right, there we go. That's enough. Roddy McDowall, legend. I cannot believe he's in this movie.
Another
uncredited
legend.
Too.
Yeah, another uncredited legend, the voice of Old Bob.
Oof.
Slim Pickens.
Man, his voice just slides into this movie. like an elephant sliding into a pile of glass. It's just...
hot mess.
Yeah. Man, I love Slim Pickens, but Jesus. This movie takes some really weird choices.
Yep,
very
like
weird
that.
Choices. That's one of them. So now we have a cast, but we need all these people to dance to music, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, we're following up on Star Wars, so we're looking for this big, exciting, bombastic soundtrack. So, Courtney, tell me how that all comes together, because it is highly exciting, right?
Yes. There's highly choreographed dance numbers, and the music was written by John Barry.
Who is that?
Well, yes.
Go ahead, Pete.
No, please.
Okay, so John Barry is a prolific composer.
Yeah.
He has 121 composing credits on IMDb.
Oh, so not many.
No, not many, just a few. Some of those include Walkabout, Mary Queen of Scots, A Doll's House, Somewhere in Time, Body Heat, Howard the Duck, Peggy Sue Got Married, Chaplin, and Indecent Proposal. That's just to name a few, but you'd probably know him best for his scoring for 11 of the James Bond films. He actually received the Golden Eye Award for his contributions to the Bond franchise. And a little fun fact to go along with that. Anybody remember the song Millennium by Robbie Williams?
Vaguely.
I barely remember Robbie Williams. I remember he fell down while walking on stage once.
Right. So the beginning of that song goes. So that's the opening to You Only Live Twice, which was written by John Barry. And when John Barry was asked about Robbie Williams, he said, "I wouldn't know Robbie Williams if I fell over him."
My God.
It's pretty hilarious. This score was nominated for Best Music by the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films. And another fun fact is that this is one of the last two films, along with Star Trek The Motion Picture, to feature a formal overture, which, if you've seen this movie, there's like 6 minutes of black at the beginning, and we're wondering if our TVs are broken or like what's happening. That's the overture. And then finally, he was nominated for a lot of awards in his lifetime, but he did win 5 Oscars, one for Best Music, Original Music Score for Born Free in 1967. He also won Original Song for Born Free from the same film. He won Best Music Original Score in 1969 for The Lion in Winter, Best Music Original Score for Out of Africa in 1986, and Best Music Original Score for Dances with Wolves in 1990.
But he also did The Black Hole.
He also did. Well, okay, so I will say this about the score. You won't ever forget this theme. Ryan and I and Aileen and Jim were all singing this in his room last night. And it plays forever. It plays for 500 years when they're running throughout the ship when it's exploding and there's a giant flame ball and everything. I mean, you don't forget the theme. But it isn't, I wouldn't say, a terribly original theme. I think it's fun and, you know, fun music. And I don't know if it's fitting for a lot of the things that are happening when that music's playing. But you won't forget it.
Like, of all the things that this, you know, that this, obviously they were trying to really ape 2001 also. But for a movie that was trying to sound like Star Wars, they wound up sounding more like what Spaceballs sounds like later. Yeah.
Yeah, so what? There's that one theme, that specific theme sounds like the music that plays before the wedding starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds just like that.
It's such a weird little... Yeah, it just went on forever, too. That was the thing. Like, it's just looping and looping and looping and looping.
The same theme. He doesn't have many different themes going on throughout.
So all of this comes together in a cacophony of sound and acting and this and that. And it is brought to its debut on December 18th, 1979, in London. That's a world premiere.
London.
Keep in mind, it would then open just 3 days later, the 21st, in the States. This was Disney's big holiday release. Let's compare that to, like, they're releasing the Mary Poppins sequel this holiday. This was their thing in the year of 79. So, as Ryan brought up before, it was released almost alongside of a Star Trek motion picture. So that's actually now two movies that really try to ape the feel of 2001 and just don't succeed on any grounds. But it only had a $20 million budget. It made $36. So it is a financial success. But the reviews to it, not very kind. Many calling it pretentious, heavy-handed, various ways. It also has the distinction, I think we said this just before, first ever PG-rated Disney film. We did say that just before, didn't we?
Well, we've said it now.
We said it now if we didn't say it before. But what about us? What do we think? Anyone else have any pre-production stuff they want to throw in there? Melissa?
I have some miscellaneous stuff, not pre-production.
Do you want to bring it up as we kind of... Go ahead, because then actually I have a little tale to tell.
Okay, well, I just think it's really interesting. There was talk of a remake for this film. It was originally going to be John Spates, who was the one with Prometheus. He was actually signed as screenwriter, but then in March 2018, so really recent, Emily Carmichael, who co-wrote Pacific Rim Uprising and Jurassic World 3, was reported to be writing the film. So that's where that's gone.
Happy that didn't happen. Based on that. There was something I read on IMDb.
Yes.
And it involved the character of Harlan Ellison, who was an absolute larger-than-life character. He was brief. I'm going to just tell you exactly what it says on IMDb. Harlan Ellison was briefly brought on as a scientific consultant on the film. He was fired on his first day before lunch was over because he pitched an animated porno movie starring Disney characters. Roy Edward Disney was sitting at the next table, heard everything, and had Ellison fired on the spot. Ellison insists he was simply joking, but others who were there say he was talking about it sincerely. Okay. So, Neil Gaiman was very close friends with the now passed away Harlan Ellison. So I asked Neil Gaiman on Twitter if this story has any validity. His first response was, "You don't seriously pitch a Disney porno movie in the lunch hall." And I said, "That's what I figured. I can see him making a joke of it and everyone buying him as serious." He then said, "I don't believe anyone, including Roy Disney, thought it was anything other than funny shtick or inappropriate and not funny shtick." So he basically gave me the most Harlan Ellison answer of all time, playing both sides of that. Am I interpreting that right, or am I reading that tweet wrong?
Nope, you're absolutely right.
Okay. So there you have it from Neil Gaiman himself, giving us the most Harlan Ellison of answers of all time, because that man should be Willy Wonka, Harlan Ellison. You should never know if the stories about him are true or untrue. So that is something I said. Oh, little thing, Ryan, you won't believe this, or maybe you will, because you already knew. Before the movie came out, Disney ran a 26-week comic strip. And who was that drawn by, Ryan Wilson?
Oh, I do know this.
It rhymes.
Because it's with... No, don't even do that, because I know that. I know that. It's killing me, because I know I know. Because it's just a huge name, and it's sitting here, and yep. I'm suddenly... It's Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby, that's right.
It's Jack Kirby.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Another thing, this is sort of a weird connection to 2001, because Jack Kirby drew a 2001 Space Odyssey comic for Marvel when it came out. So they wound up doing something semi-serious. Did you ever see this before?
I've seen the collections. They did comic books that were another interpretation of it that he had some, like, artistic pieces on. But I've never seen all full 26 pieces put together, which you consider the artwork behind this movie. You can see you have this on the backside of the marketing tied in with the Walt Disney, The Wonderful World of Color, did an episode called Major Effects where they were promoting the movie. You know, we bring Peter Ellenshaw out of retirement. His son, Harrison, takes on the work of the movie. He produces, 150 matte paintings, and they only use 13 of them in the movie. I really think Disney needs to just do, an art of our weird science fiction movies and just put like this and Tron and a couple of other things together, because there is some gold there.
I would love to see some of the stuff that got tossed aside on that, but what about what we have? Let's start from the beginning. There's a line right from the start. We're not going to go into the 15-minute overture because it's a long overture. There is a hint of what the finish of this film is going to be right from the very start of this film. I believe it's
Pizer.
It was Pizer who says something like, "It what is that like? We're going right into the hell or something like that."
Every time I look down a black hole, I expect to see the devil sitting there or something along those lines.
Yeah. So they kind of tell you where this is going. So my question to you, if you haven't watched the film and you're listening to this, don't worry. You can keep listening. Have you ever seen the movie Event Horizon?
Yes.
You've pretty much seen the black hole. And those two things should not line up with each other. But in a lot of ways, it does. So as we said before, tons of people in this movie, Ernest Borgnine, Anthony Perkins, not in drag. It's good. Good to see him out of non-drags. It's trying to be a serious sci-fi film from the get-go.
No.
I feel like it is. And then they cut to Vincent.
Yeah.
And a googly-eyed, which it wasn't supposed to be googly-eyed. They evidently did have digital eyes, and they couldn't get them to work. They really just chose the child's arts and crafts section of solutions for this, though. And like right from the start, I didn't understand what the tone of this movie was supposed to be.
No, because then you also have Kate, who has ESP with robots.
Yeah. Yeah, so the crew is nearing a black hole, discovers there's a ship that really shouldn't be there anymore. Everything is kind of fine, except for Vincent looking like a googly-eyed robot. And then the line is, see if you can get through to Vincent with your ESP.
Yeah, they call it out.
What?
The only thing Vincent should be picking up as a robot is ESPN. Two, you got to consider who the designer was on Vincent. This is George McGinnis work. This is the man who did the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea subs with Goff. The guy who was in charge of Horizons and part of the land, and this is a big name in Disney, and they were just like, we're just gonna take six different kind of eyeballs and glue them on when we need them for the different effects.
It doesn't look good.
And then put a heart monitor on the front of him.
Yep.
He also looks like one of those push tops that you like push and he like spins. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, but then he comes all the way out, and then you can see his robot brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a reveal that no one needed to see at all. Yeah. Also, when he's outside the ship, during one of the many ship in crisis sequences, like those seem to never end. He shoots like a little plunger out of his arm to save him and gets to the door.
He's a Dalek.
That is the sound of the door opening on the USS Enterprise. Not kind of, not sort of. I am damn near positive it is the exact sound.
Sound copyright then?
So, Courtney, I'm getting the impression you're not a big fan of this movie.
Well, I've seen it 3 times now.
It's so many times.
Sorry. That's too many times for anyone to see this movie. I don't think I'll ever forget it. let's see. What more can I say? I don't understand most of what happened and why. If I see one more person act like they're floating because of anti-gravity, I'm going to scream. I think Ryan.
So with that,
here.
The original script called for them to be weightless the entire time, and they realized what a bad idea that was. It's like, you know what? Once we dock with Cygnus, we're getting rid of the gravity effects.
Yeah,
it was like also really inconsistent. Even in the opening, it was like they were all kind of standing around, and then all of a sudden, like one of them like came floating down, and then did like a somersault back up. I don't know. It was really weird, and I was just like, are they supposed to be weightless? Are they weightless away from the desk? It was very odd.
I love
how they're all just kind of like floating. Like they all look like they're on an inner tube.
Yeah.
Like a slight wake.
Except for Pizer. Pizer just has no time for any of it. He just looks like he's on an elevator and then he's done.
And Sidney Perkins isn't having it either. He's just like standing there. So like half of them are like, you know, surfing, and the other ones are just like, no, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, so I was so confused as to like when was actually the weightless gravity thing in effect.
Basically, it was just whenever they wanted. I love how they just fixed the idea. They're like, oh, well, never mind. When they dock, they'll just have gravity. It reminds me of the movie Smoking. Thank you for smoking. Thank you for not smoking. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where they're discussing, okay, we're going to put this scene where they're in space and they make love. And afterwards, they light up a cigarette and they're smoking and it looks really sexy. And Aaron Eckhart's character's like, wouldn't they explode? Because like they're in space and it's all oxygen. And Rob Lowe's like, yeah. But before that, we'll just say, hey, isn't it great that we created the thing that we can smoke in space now? And we just move on. And that's what that comes out to me like.
Yes.
Hey, guys, we can't really work this out. Oh, well, you know, we'll just – they have gravity now. Don't worry about it. No one really – because really no one cares. But, you know. So, yeah, we have a series of pops and whizzes gone bad. The crew docks with this ship that is supposed to be lost but is somewhat magically – or not magically – near this black hole. It's called the Cygnus. Every time someone said it, I heard down with the Cygnus. which was really annoying. And upon boarding the Cygnus, their weapons are destroyed, and people who clearly people walking like robots appear on the screen in the most robot-y movement of all time. And we meet Maximilian, hashtag not Cylon. Which is all I can say towards that. And from that, he's basically like this muscle robot who really bros up a lot of times. It's kind of a weird thing. And from there, we meet I Light Captain Nemo, Dr. Hans Reinhardt. Which, that I Light that they give him in the very intro is the most Morticia Adams-ass thing. And they never do it again. They only do it that one time.
And for a long time, I couldn't tell who was, like, going to be evil. Like, if Maximilian was going to be evil.
What? Really?
Like, oh, no. I meant, like if it was, like, Maximilian was going to be just the evil one and he was controlling Dr. Reinhardt. Or
okay.
Dr. Reinhardt was controlling him or, like...
It's like a Wall-E situation.
Yeah, like what the actual... AI. Like, where the evil lied.
I knew Maximilian was evil right away as soon as he flipped over upside down like a jerk.
What was that all about?
I don't know, man. Blows my mind. Vincent's like, well, I guess I better be upside down, and then does a full 360.
I never understood. I was like, why did he just do that? He just went upside down.
It's robot one-upsmanship.
so damn weird.
All the better to see you.
Let's do some role-playing. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to do some role-playing. I'm going to be Dr. Hans Reinhardt, and I'm going to play him the way he basically plays the entire first 15 minutes.
No.
Ryan, ask me any series of questions that you can pop up in your head. Anything. Come on.
How do you keep the ship near the black hole?
How do I keep the ship near the black hole? Everything. Question for a question. That's all this cat does. It is.
Where are all the people on this ship?
All the people.
Where are the people?
Where are they? Like, what? No, just where are they?
Where? Until he's yelling.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine then.
And trying to be rescued. That's what happens, yeah.
What a turn he takes later on, right?
He was really into the Socratic method.
So Reinhardt, who is totally sane, intends to fly through a black hole. And Norman Bates is like, yeah, let's go. What in any of this scenario would make someone be like, all right. You know, like, this is obviously the Nemo thing and all that. So in 20,000 Leagues, though, you sort of get where Nemo's coming from. You know, there's a part that you can connect with because of the wife and the child and all that. This is just, you know, man legitimately twirling his mustache or his beard, which is phenomenal. But I just, he's clearly the most insane person on Earth. But there we are. Yeah, space madness.
Yeah, space I kept weapons. Calling them space. I think, oh look, there's Space Nemo, and oh yeah. look, there's Space Aronox, like or Aronox. I'm like, I mean, you could see the roles being defined there, like, and there is, there's definitely a sense of, okay, this is a scientific achievement. Yeah, it, but it, you know, Anthony Perkins plays everything so straight that it's so really straight. Hard to get a read on anything he's doing.
But then he also looks so crazy that I couldn't tell like if he was like legitimately like, yeah, let's do this, or like he was like, nah, I'm gonna kill my crew too. Like, let's do this.
And then you get the last minute romance that came out of left field.
Oh yes! My god, yeah. When Forrester kisses Mimu.
On
her cheek while she's half unconscious.
Hands, and then yeah, it's like, wait, where did this start? What happened? Yeah,
there's no build up to that at all. So so Norman Bates wants to go with him into the black hole. Fine. All right. You know what? At least this gives us like a little bit of a conflict between the crew and the obviously totally insane dude who wants to fly them through a black hole. While this is going on, Captain Holland, who's Robert Forster, he witnesses like a funeral for a robot, which is the name of my new band, Funeral for a Robot.
That's a good name.
And Ernest Borgnine tries to like chummy up with a robot, and the robot's like, nah, I got my bum leg. I got to get out of here. So now Ernest Borgnine is all confused. Everyone thinks something is up. But again, Norman's just totally on board. Then we meet Slim Pickens' robot named Bob, and we have a Duck Hunt-ass competition shootout between robots? What the hell is going on in this middle section? Like, what was the point of that entire thing? Was that just to get the robot that could shoot them off the board? Was that what that was?
I don't know. I took it as, like, they were, like, interacting more and more with these robots that were on the ship and just getting like the hint that the robots weren't maybe nothing was not everything was kosher. We'll put it that way.
Okay.
I think it was maybe to partially show the difference between what we've come to find are the humans that are still on board and how their roles are versus the robots who actually have a personality.
Okay.
And
yeah.
are just a bunch of bullies effectively. With, you know, Star-Lord guns is what they're walking around with.
Yeah, and they're about as good of a shot as Star Troopers.
No, well, not the sharpshooting guy. He's good.
No, yeah. but there is a sequence.
Yes, there's a sequence later on.
Funny story with that is the helmets were so restrictive and so that they couldn't see anything. And they had a hard time hearing that it was almost impossible to direct them, particularly when they were doing shooting battle scenes, which you can see that in every scene where there's a battle scene with those robots.
So then what else we had? The thing, you know, with that whole shooting sequence, Courtney, there was the first time we saw like super shooting robot. He twirls his guns very wild, wild west style and puts them into his non-holsters. But then later, in a different take, instead of twirling these guns, he legitimately just waves them like this.
He was charging.
And then puts them down. And I made a GIF of it, and I put it in the group. And I'm just, I don't understand who made that decision. Where the guy was like, look, man, I cannot twirl these things one more time. And they're like, all right, well, what if you just wave them at nothing? He's like, all right, I can do that. How many takes do you need? One take. And then there we go.
I don't know. Is he trying to, like, is it supposed to be the effect of him, like, twirling the guns around his fingers?
I think he's trying to get that effect.
But he can't do it?
He's like the world's worst David Copperfield right here.
Yeah, he's pretty bad.
I thought we were setting this up, you know, this was, and I've seen this movie more times than I want to admit to. But I always thought as a child that was kind of setting up a battle between him and Pizer, like a showdown between the two of them. Because Pizer's doing the same thing every time you see him. He's twirling guns and doing like the pew pew effects, like in the middle of a hallway by himself.
Oh yeah.
And so that's the shootout, right? Like this is the old west shootout, and then we never get that shot.
Yeah, because they just kill him right there.
Yeah.
The robot that's supposed to be like the big thing, they just kind of kill him. I mean, I guess. Second to the big thing, which the big thing would be Maximilian. Guys, all of this takes about 45 minutes that we just talked about. The movie is so plotting in its movements. There are points where it's snappy and it moves along.
But then you
like
get
when Daft Punk shows up.
Like what?
Like when Daft Punk shows up.
Yes. And then you get the 20 minutes where they're sneaking across the bridge and, you know, being
well,
very
we don't even
quiet.
Get. We don't even get Reinhardt for the first 26 minutes. Like, he's top bill on this movie, and we don't see him for the first third of this movie.
So, moving forward, robots killing robots. Things seem weird. And basically, what happens is Slim Pickens and Roddy McDowell figure out that these humans, that these robots may not be robots. They might be something else. Oh no, they might be humans. Then Vincent speaks to Kate through telepathy. So the robot knows telepathy also?
I think it's part of the ESPN package.
Yeah.
This is the strangest set of circumstances. And he basically, you know, tells him, like, you know, hey, you better look into this whole robot thing. So she goes over to one of the robots, takes off its mask. Oh, no, I'm sorry. She's about to.
Yeah.
And she gets stopped by Nemo. And then, you know, knowing that when you put someone in a rocking chair and turn them away from you, Norman Bates is like, the jig is up. Takes the mask off. And it's pretty creepy looking zombie face, as a matter of fact.
I will say that.
This was
the most horrifying part of this movie.
Yes, Ryan.
And that's actually the director. That's Gary Nelson.
I thought you were going to say that's an actual corpse.
He was so sold on that. He was like, no, I want to do that part.
So now everyone, you know, now the whole crew is like, oh my God, this person's crazy. It's crazy, I tell you.
Because it turns out he lobotomized his entire crew to make them into his workers.
Yes.
So all the people that you've been seeing around the ship, you know, all the robots you've been seeing around the ship, not Vincent or Bob or Maximilian, but they're actually humans.
Yeah, they're actually humans being used against their will as zombie robots. So Maximilian, not okay with this reveal. Not okay that people are finding out the plan. So the Christmas time release from Disney goes to a robot drilling a hole through the chest of Anthony Perkins.
And he looks like that in the Monsters, Inc. when he picked me up and shook me like a dog. That's what he looks like when he dies. It steams out of his mouth and he's just convulsing.
And that's it. There's just a straight murder. And Nemo is like, oh, don't. And then he doesn't listen to him.
No, stop.
So he goes up to Kate, the daughter of the father who he killed earlier also, because her father was part of the original crew, tried to have a mutiny against him, and Nemo kills him. And he goes up to her, and he's like, save me from Maximilian. It's like, wait a minute. What?
Yeah, that's what I was like, so which one's the evil one?
So, yeah, he has a change of heart, but he only has a change of heart because he doesn't want to miss out on the opportunity to actually go into the black hole. So, you know, that's the thing. So anyway, they take away Kate. Kate gets taken away and she's going to be made into a robot.
Burrito.
No? A burrito. Yeah, she has like a burrito. Yeah. Like, what shall we wrap her in, sir? Saran. And then aluminum. but don't worry. Hubbard Chase saves her because they're in love. I don't know. And we have a very, very action-y sequence with, again, just the least hype music that you can imagine. And then a long gunfight occurs. And this is, I think, Melissa, what you were referring to with the great aiming.
Yeah. Yeah, with the pew-pews going everywhere.
But you know what? I think, like, okay, at least the human characters, they're ducking in and out of cover.
No, yeah. They're good.
But they can't hit stationary targets. No. That, like, they're not moving at all. The robots aren't moving at all.
They're just so entrenched in there, moving and ducking, that they can't hit the target.
Yeah, so that shooting sequence goes on for 8 minutes? It goes
and
on
in
for,
it we get the we lose Ernest Borgnine in the middle of this,
right?
Because he decided to just take off. He was like, "Forget it, I'm getting out of here."
That's right.
He wants to go back on the other ship, right?
Right, and so that's how they're trying to get back to the probe, Space Nemo's probe, because that can go. You know, that can pull away from an event horizon, so they should be able to get out of there in that. So now they're going all the way back across the ship. And you know, because their ship's been blown up, so we're losing crew members left and right at this point.
Yeah, and we get to the Van Horizon thing where it's like we got to make it to the escape pod because we're going to destroy the rest of the ship, and everyone's trying to do that, and none of it is exciting. None of it's exciting. But I will say there was one really cool looking thing when that giant lava lamp comes rolling down the middle of that hallway. I was like, you know what, that looks pretty cool. At first, I thought it was like a river of lava, but then I remembered at the beginning there was the two robots who were playing with like the space globe and the water globe, and I had no idea what either of them were doing. I think it was the hot looking globe.
No, it was so there's like asteroids outside or something that were pummeling the ship. And one of them crashed in, and it comes rolling through, a la Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I was gonna say it's just an Indiana Jones moment.
Okay, so I missed this.
Which asteroids should
don't
be cold,
roll.
Right? And they should be cold, not hot. So we just assume that it's future flaming hot Cheetos that are just attacking the ship, and that's what we found.
And that's why it took so long for them to get to us, and then put kids in the hospital for eating them.
So. All right, so that was supposed to be, all right, sure.
Yeah, because it was like
it was rolling down the hallway as if the velocity of a comet was like, slow down. And of a meteor was like, just slow down. We got a hallway to roll down.
Which makes the whole thing about like the greenhouse and them freezing in there or being covered in asbestos or whatever was happening. Like that makes that even weirder because the asteroids are hot. And then they're getting frozen out in the greenhouse. So what is happening in science?
There is no science.
A whole lot of nothing. No.
There is no science. There is only Zool.
Least scientific film of all time.
Yeah.
Yes. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So, now, so that, many levels. Now that everything's blowing up, as we said, everyone's like, we got to get to that probe ship. But how does Reinhardt meet his end? By a sweet-ass big-screen television. And this is basically his punishment for calling it his man cave. Just a large monitor falls on him. Kind of unceremoniously. He looks towards Maximilian to save him, and the robot's like, nah, I'm a robot, motherfucker. You know, he's out. He's just, I gotta go and
like, sorry, bro.
Flip upside down and show off these sweet robot packs. all right, so we're getting near the end. Slim Pickens gets killed by a Cylon, then the Cylon gets drilled through the chest, just like he drilled through Norman Bates. Oh, cyclical. Oh. And keep this in mind. Off he goes into the black hole. Remember that for later, because something crazy is going to happen.
So in case you weren't following, Maximilian went into the black hole.
Maximilian, aka Cylon, went off into the black hole. Reinhardt's body, still supposedly on the ship, not into the black hole.
Not yet.
Don't worry about that, though.
Poor Bob.
The crew escapes, thinking they are saved, but uh-oh. The computer's navigation system has been set to the black hole. So without anyone making an effort to disable it...
Exactly. You have a robot on the ship. Like, this, we've gone through all these sci-fi movies. Like, hello, tell the robot to reprogram the ship.
Nope.
That's
they don't even
happens.
Try. They're just like,
no,
we're
they just
going
accept
into
it.
The black hole, guys.
They're like, let's hold hands and go.
They Toy Story 3 it.
The robot knows ESP and nothing else.
That's it. He can only communicate.
He doesn't know code.
He can only communicate with human minds.
Not
but
fellow
he
computers.
Doesn't know BIOS. He doesn't know DOS. It's fine.
It was Linux. He's right. Confused.
Yeah, maybe it's a Linux. He's like, I don't know this. I haven't worked on Linux in years. Okay, then things happen.
Then even crazier things happen.
Yeah, so up to this point, this movie has been pretty straightforward. Except for the robot zombie look. I thought that was pretty like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool.
It's pretty dark.
Outside of that, though, it is your sort of like very Buck Rogers-y, you know, kind of corn fest that's trying to take itself seriously every like ninth minute. But then everything else occurs around it, and you're like, well, this is just silly. Because Otis Bergman is in it. So this is how the movie wraps up. And we're going to have to – we're going to meditate on this one. Reinhardt now finds himself also going towards a black hole. But he has, like, super sexy time with Maximilian as they stare into each other's eyes. And, like, basically Superman, Lois Lane in the 78, you know, can you read my mind? Which, if it was Kate, she'd be like, yeah, actually, I can read your mind because you're a goddamn robot. And that's what I do. I read robot minds. But this is Maximilian and Reinhardt. And as they're staring lovingly into each other's eyes, they merge into one. And then we see them as the rulers of hell, because they're on top of the overlord. Mountain. They're on top of the mountain looking down on a bunch of cloaked figures. And after going through the black hole, they're in this hellish landscape with a bunch of druids wearing cloaks below them as they stand on top of a mountain.
I played this level in Diablo. It pans out.
What the hell is going on?
Hell.
They are literally in hell, right?
I think they are.
It's not...
See, the black hole was a teleportation, and because Maximilian and Dr. Reinhardt were evil, they wind up in hell.
So you think they got judged?
Yes. The black hole judges also, all.
The hell also kind of looks like the crash Cygnus. Like, if you start looking at it, like, you can see, like, the girder work. You can see kind of... So it's like a mountain plus a crashed ship. So they just landed on, like, planet hell is what it seems like.
Okay, but... Did he bring all the robot humans with him and they're all like his slaves for eternity now? Because there seem to be a lot of people down there.
Right. And we were talking about that because it was like, well, wait, why would the poor drones go to hell? Like, why wouldn't they have escaped that fate?
Yeah, they don't seem to really have much of a choice in the matter.
I mean, unless it's just regular hell in which, like, there's probably a millennia of people in there anyway.
Mm. All right, true. Yes, yes. But we still don't know where the crew went.
Yeah, we do.
No, we don't know if they went to hell.
Oh, wait, but you mean the old crew? You mean Reinhardt's old crew?
The Cygnus crew.
Yeah,
right.
The Cygnus crew. Oh, down with the Cygnus crew.
No, no.
Ooh, wah. So on the flip side of that coin, we have Holland, Pizer, Kate, and Vincent, and Ernest Borgnine. He only broke his leg, right? He made it to the ship, didn't he?
No, he got blown up.
Oh, that's right. Okay, he doesn't make it. Sad ending right now. They go through the literal gates of heaven, complete with floating angel, and on the other side of it, they approach a giant planet backlit by a star. It is really trying to sound like 2001 here a lot.
Even like their whole ship going through the black hole, I thought was very 2001-ish. Like,
yeah, like
not in a good way, but
yeah.
Like, they reused the shot a couple times, but...
It's the Tilt-A-Whirl shot that everyone's like, no, I can't watch this, I'm going to throw up.
Yeah.
So that is how it ends. That's how we end. We end with this ship flying towards heaven, which is a planet, evidently, and has nighttime, so that's good. If you don't like, you know, if you still have like a normal sleep schedule, don't worry. There's some phases of the sun or whatever. So the black hole... is an actual portal to heaven and hell, and where you go depends on the type of person you are. As you pass through it, you are judged, maybe even mixed up into the body of a robot, which kind of sounds cool.
It's the robot devil.
I think you should take that section of the movie and put the song To Become One behind it.
Nice.
So that's how we end. That's how we end. That's the end of the film, guys, ladies, gentlemen, children. So
there are some versions of this where in some of the re-releases they take out the heaven piece at the cathedral they take that piece out and just show them on the other side of the black hole because they're like, maybe we got too metaphorical here. Maybe we went a little too far to one side. It's fine that they crashed and they're in hell over here, but you know the others just basically went through a white hole. Which is a whole another theoretical piece, and they come out the other side and they get to live another day.
Is that it? So, in the interpretation that the movie's giving us, Courtney, are those people dead and they went to heaven?
Yes, I'm going full Melissa on this one and saying everyone died and went to heaven. That's what I think happened. Ryan and I discussed it last night too.
Ryan, are you in the boat of this?
No, I think that they. That somewhere in there, there's a message. But no, I think that the others got through the other side and are probably on the far side of the galaxy and are going to die soon anyway, because they're going to be on an uninhabited world with no way to take care of themselves. But their original mission was to seek out new life and new civilizations, so they're kind of doing that in that respect. So I'll take it that those four made it out.
So you think they interstellared themselves?
Yes.
Okay. Hopefully one of them has a daughter named Murph. Speaking of Murph, that Four Crackers, Noel, what's that movie?
The Nutcracker and the Four Realms?
The Four Chambers of Death, what's going on?
Noel.
What's that Christmas
Sad
thing?
That I knew that. The Nutcracker and the Four Realms.
Nutcrackers and the Four Realms. Featuring Murph! That's coming out soon.
It's out.
Do you think anyone ends up in hell in that movie at the end?
There's four realms. I don't know.
I think anybody in the audience may be in hell in that movie.
Do you think someone was like, look, people really like this Mr. Toad ride. Why don't we take the finish of this and go to hell? All right. So that's the movie. And now we're going to give our opinions on whether or not, what are our thoughts on it. So, Melissa... Now is the best time to ask the questions that we ask, which are?
Yes.
What are they?
All right. We're going to figure out if it still holds up. We're going to figure
we'll
out
save that for last.
The iconic shot.
Save that for second to last, I guess.
And I guess we'll talk about moral and or emotional goals of the film and if it succeeds at either and or both.
Courtney, go at it.
Okay. So I think this film has a moral, and I think the moral is don't be a murderous douchebag.
It's a good moral. I can get behind this.
That's my takeaway.
Does it achieve this?
I don't want to be a murderous douchebag after watching this movie. I certainly don't want to turn all my friends into Daft Punk. Like,
but
I'm not a
do cat. You want to gain a robot body and rule over hell?
Only if the song Two Become One is playing in the background.
All right. Okay.
You know they're going back on tour. Very excited.
I'm ready. Let's go, Melissa.
So excited.
All right. So you think this does not complete its goal of successfully getting that moral, or you think it does?
Not really.
Ryan.
Yep.
Wilson.
Yes.
What is the heart backbone of this film? What is it trying to tell you?
I don't think it's an emotional. I think it is a moral message. I think it's trying to steal 20,000 Leagues' message of, science versus ethics, man versus, man. But it does a really poor job of getting there, and I don't think that it necessarily does. I think it just leaves you really confused.
Melissa.
I'll go with that. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely probably some, early stages of
dementia.
How far science can bring people to the brink of doing unethical things, and should we or should we not destroy our humanity in order to achieve our scientific goals, and probably a lot of other lofty ideas that you can throw out, but I don't know, it just falls so flat that, meh. I don't know if it does a good job of getting those morals across.
I think it is so heavy-handed, its hand falls on the ground, spilling the cup of the reasoning. It's very blatant what they're trying to get across, but they don't say anything interesting about it. They just say the same thing that everyone's always said and done better in previous movies. Yep. It's a cool concept, though. It is kind of a cool concept, there's this portal, and we think that it can lead us to different worlds, but that other world is an ethereal sign of judgment, or literal heaven and hell, however you want to take it. And almost to achieve getting through that, you have to commit the crimes that you need to do it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. It's man's reach is, exceeding his grasp.
His grasp
is one of the things. Like, they would have got there eventually, but Reinhardt wanted it now. He wanted it to be him. You know, he always knew he would be the most renowned scientist of his time. You know, that arrogance.
Yeah.
And it's through that that he, you know, faces, you know, his ultimate fate. But the idea that you could pass through it and not be a murderous douchebag is an option too. But you would have to have faith that going through a black hole wouldn't just, oh, I don't know, rip your existence out of, you know, out of everything, out of reality. So there's a number of ways they really could have done an interesting version of this. I really do. But so much time is taken up with slim pickings in the middle of a sci-fi movie. You know, that it just doesn't – they distract themselves so much. Is this – this might be a better movie if Disney never – if it wasn't a Disney film. If they didn't insist on some portion of it feeling like a Disney film.
But I feel like that's inaccurate because, like, I feel like you guys hit it on the head with it trying to be like 2001. Like, 20,000 Leagues. 20,000 Leagues, like, shows you that whole juxtaposition of morality and, you know, doing things for the sake of, you know, discovery and everything like that. Whereas here, I feel like, you know, they were – attempting to achieve it, but it just didn't go. I don't think that it necessarily is hurt by it being a Disney film. I think it's just hurt because they were trying maybe to do too much and weren't specific with what they wanted to.
Let me rephrase. Being very Disney in the way of, like, we've got to have a wacky robot. Like, the most wacky thing you could say about 2001 is the seal. I mean, Jesus, about 20,000 Leagues. Is the seal, you know, the seal like playing along with the guitar or something like that. But that's it, you know. Everyone else is pretty much playing a straight role. But Vincent and Bob make it so corny whenever they're on screen. Those eyes are just the most distracting thing.
But even like without that, like the fact that they wrote in the fact that she has to have ESP with a robot, like, I don't know. It's just they made some really odd choices.
Yeah. Yeah,
and this movie could have done with an epilogue, with something, you know, don't leave it ambiguous at the end, like just spell it out, you know, that like whether you're 20, you know, all of 20,000 Leagues, where it's Nemo doing a voiceover, or it's, you know, however you need to do it, there needs to be like one more scene that just gives you some kind of bookend to the movie.
Yeah, maybe if they even focus on that planet that's supposed to be quote unquote heaven, and like it's right. Has life on it, and like you see the ship going towards it, so like they are safe or something like that. Like,
I'm okay with ambiguous ending. I'm all right with that. I think it's pretty clear that like they're okay. They're going to a good place, and Nemo went to hell. I mean, I think that's pretty clear.
Space Nemo.
I just think they could have shaved 25 minutes of people running away from stiff robots.
Yes.
And maybe given, you know, not Nemo, more of a thing for me to care about him. Because I don't care about him at all. Which is, you know, probably the problem. Because I like the character of Nemo.
Yeah.
But Space Nemo does nothing for me.
Put him in the funeral scene. Like, have him stump, you know, have him come in there and then talk there about things. And, like, you know, not give away that there are people. Not give away. But put some humanity behind
Show
it.
Show some remorse.
Yeah.
Show some remorse. I think that would have went a long way. What is the iconical – that's not a word. What is the iconic shot of this movie? Melissa.
Oh.
Melissa doesn't remember the movie well enough, I don't think, to even recall if there was one.
Because I also feel like this is such – for me, it was like such a hodgepodge of images that
– Oh, you're absolutely right.
Nothing really stuck out except
googly eyes.
Robot – man meld on top of the mountain in hell.
Well, yeah, all right. If you want to say that, the shot of him on top of the mountain. On top of the mountain. You can go with that. Is that good?
It's so terrible, but yeah.
Courtney, how great would it have been if, like, right at that point, the camera's backing up? Like, you know, it's like, boom, boom. Oklahoma, where the wind comes rushing down the plain.
No, not Oklahoma.
No,
we don't want Oklahoma. We want climb every mountain. I prefer that one.
Okay, all right. Courtney, what is the most iconic shot to you? Does this movie have one?
I mean, I want it to be Vincent all the time, but I think I'll just do the Cygnus with the black hole in the background, just kind of the shot of the ship, because really, I mean, I don't know what else. I don't know if this movie is like iconic enough to have an iconic shot. So.
Yeah,
that's what I'll go with.
Ryan, what have you drubbed from the remains?
So it's a similar shot to that. It's there's space and a little bit of the black hole, but it's when the lights first come on in the Cygnus as the Palomino is flying over it. And you get that long, like that long shot of the ship with all the lights on, and you can see all the details on the ship with space in the background. Like that shot is one of the ones that always stuck with me.
I'm going to give a big hands up in the air praise shot to Angel Lady floating down the corridor of whatever the hell that was, because that's an image I'll never forget, and that's an image that you could put up any like. You could put that in front of me, I'd be like, black hole. Like, immediately. Because nothing else will look like that, I hope.
That it kind of reminded me of something out of... That reminds me a little bit of something out of, like, one of the Christmas carols.
Oh, no, yes. You reminded me of Fantasia during the Ave Maria scene. But, like, done not well, where they're going through the trees. Like, I feel like that's what they were going for. But no.
The angel from The Muppets Christmas Carol, the little creepy doll.
No, not that one.
Yes.
I'm a human face. No, you're not.
I'm trying to remember Alistair Sim or George Scott. It's one of those two. I want to say that there's an image. There's some image in there somewhere that reminds me of that.
All right. Final question. Melissa.
Yes.
Does this movie hold up?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, because it's not corny enough to make it last, and it's too just, I don't know, dead in the middle to actually make it enjoyable. And obviously it is the least scientific of it.
Ever.
Ever.
I'm going to say it doesn't hold up either. I wish I could, though. There's some parts that I really like the ideas behind them, but they're just not executed well. They're executed very sloppy. And when you compare this year to what other people were making in the sci-fi genre, this looks flat out silly. Especially the design on the robots. They look just silly, like ridiculous silly. Courtney, I know it's a yes.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say this is my new favorite movie. I'm about to go watch it again right after this. I'm on it. I won't ever watch this again. I didn't like. The thing is, I don't really hate it. I think that there's entertainment value. If you watch it with other people, this is definitely one of those movies that you can like talk over and make fun of in just a whole lot. And maybe make a drinking game out of it. Maybe every time you see a Daft Punk robot, you take a shot.
Oh, you're dead.
Everyone would die.
You'd go to hell.
Every time Vincent has different eyeball shape, then you take it. I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't hold up. It definitely doesn't hold up, but it's entertaining for what it is.
Ryan Wilson.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that The Black Hole, 1979, holds up?
No. I have some nostalgia for this movie. I will still watch this movie. In fact, I read a theory today. I actually watched it again with no sound because there are some really striking visuals in it at moments. It's almost a better movie when there's no sound. So I recommend if you want to give that a try, somebody please. So I will watch it again. But no, it doesn't hold up, especially when you consider, you know, the movies that it's trying to imitate are just much better representations of the genre. The pieces that are lacking in this, the fact that Vincent has to have glowing red eyes when he's using his ESP, I don't know why that has to be a thing.
So good.
But it doesn't hold up.
Well, folks, there you have it. I mean, what more can be said about the black hole? Is there something more? Oh, I thought you were raising your hand.
Sorry,
that was terrifying for a moment. I was like, no, not more.
Well, actually...
unfortunately, this movie didn't sit too well with us in the overall. I do think I agree, though, with both Ryan and Courtney. You can watch this with a group of people and have a pretty silly time. I think that's a good way of doing it.
I mean, it had to be better than the movie that shall not be reviewed on this
yes,
show.
That one. Yes.
Voldemort the movie.
But hey, guys, let us know your thoughts on the black hole. I know some of you are big fans of it because I saw a lot of crying emojis while I was pointing out how silly it is before on the page. So tell me, what do you like so much about the movie? Have you watched it recently?
Most important question.
That's really the first question you need to ask yourself. And, you know, what is it that makes it work for you? And if you don't like it, what doesn't work for you? I want to hear your thoughts on it, too. Head on over to the Facebook page, Disney Magic Hour. And I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. We are going to return in 2 weeks with Midnight Madness. We are in the Coke-fueled 80s, folks.
And which I'm looking forward to the animated versions of the movies, the animated movies that are coming up in the 80s.
You should be looking forward to Midnight Madness
I've never seen it. And
it's so good. Spoilers.
We got a long ways, actually, before we get back to another animated movie.
Yeah, we're in the thick of the live action. Like, hey, guys, what are we going to do? Save money? Because this is the upcoming slate, folks. Midnight Madness, Watcher in the Woods. We're not watching Herbie Goes Bananas. Popeye, we're definitely watching and doing cocaine. Dragon Slayer, man, I didn't even know that was a Disney film. It's co-produced with Paramount. I say yes, because Peter McNichol is a hero?
No.
Yep, we're watching it, Courtney, and you're going to love it.
Hey, if we don't get Apple Dumpling Gang, you don't get Dragon Slayer.
Oh, did we skip over Apple Dumpling?
Yeah.
We've skipped quite a bit over the years. A lot.
Well, okay, so here's what we're going to do, guys. We're going to get ourselves, we're going to keep going, but picking and choosing right now. We're going to keep moving forward. Always keep moving forward. We're going to move backwards eventually and pick up on all those little ones that we didn't watch. Movies like Run Cougar Run. Maybe not. Whoa. Run Cougar Run. Or, you know, The Boat
The Absent-Minded
Mix.
Professor.
Absent-Minded Professor, yes. The Million Dollar Duck. Just because of the title. Every poster from the 70s kind of looks the same. It's really great. But yeah, we will get back to Apple Dumpling and all that offers. I promise. Freaky Friday, the Shaggy DA. We have a lot of work to do. Till then, though, guys, gals, when you're hearing this, it's November 6th. I hope you went out and voted. If you didn't, but what can we do? Can't help it now. Melissa.
Yes.
Everyone knows everything already. They heard it in the beginning of the show.
They did.
But I'm going to tell them that this episode is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs or visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at MEI-travel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. And Ryan, just let everyone remind everyone where the Main Street Gazette lay.
If you go to mainstgazette.com, that's the main site, and you can connect to us through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all through there.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week. We hope to see you in 2 more weeks when we go into Midnight Madness. A very young Michael J. Fox, Fagga Beefy. You'll learn what that means. Say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Courtney.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Pete. Bye.